Strange Animals Podcast. Welcome to Strange Animals Podcast. I'm your host, Kate Shaw. Yes, I know our audio quality is back to sounding like I recorded this week's episode underwater. I bought a used microphone a few weeks ago, but it only lasted about 45 minutes, and then it broke, so I'm back to my cheap one. But hopefully the brand new microphone I've ordered will be here in time for next week's episode. This week, we're looking into a monster that my mom once confused with a chimichanga while ordering at a Mexican restaurant. That's right, my mom tried to order a chupacabra for lunch. Quick, think about what the chupacabra looks like. What mental image did you just get? Was it a dog-like animal with no fur and big teeth? Or was it something stranger, a bipedal monster with spines down its back and huge eyes? What you picture may depend on where you live. The modern chupacabra story isn't very old. In Puerto Rico in late 1994, farm animals in the small towns of Orocovis and Morovis were found dead, puncture wounds on their throats and their bodies reportedly drained of blood. This sort of attack on livestock is not uncommon. I'll come back to that later. In the 1970s, newspapers referred to the mysterious livestock killer as El Vampiro de Moca. It was frequently believed to be a huge vampire bat or even a bird. Now, the word chupacabra has been around for a long time. It means goat sucker, and I distinctly remember as a kid hearing that English term applied to certain snakes that were supposed to sneak up to milk goats at night and steal their milk. Snakes don't drink milk, if you were wondering. Only mammals drink milk, and adult mammals have trouble digesting it. That's what lactose intolerance is. Anyway, someone in Puerto Rico, reports vary as to who, decided the goat sucker in this case was sucking blood, and the mystery livestock killer became El Chupacabras in the local papers. The story spread, mostly in the tabloids, and in August of 1995, housewife Madeline Tolentino looked out the window and spotted a monster that led to flat-out chupacabra hysteria in the tabloids. Her account is frequently pointed to as the most important chupacabra sighting, the patient zero, so to speak, of sightings. Tolentino's major interview wasn't conducted by the police or by seasoned journalists, though. No, UFO investigators interviewed her many months after her sighting on March 20, 1996. The interview appeared in UFO Digest. So what did Tolentino see? There's an English transcript available as a PDF, thanks to the fine folks over at Museum of Modern Mystery Podcast. I'll link to their post, and I also recommend their Chupacabra episode if you want to dig even deeper into the mystery than I do here. During the interview, Tolentino goes into such incredible detail about the monster's appearance that it's hard to believe she was able to see it so well from a window. She describes it as about 4 feet tall, bipedal with long, skinny legs with 3 webbed toes. Its long, thin arms were pulled back as though it was ready to attack, with 3 long fingers. It had big, dark gray eyes with no whites to them, although somehow Tolentino was able to note that it moved its eyes back and forth constantly. The eyes were, quote, damp and protruding, running up to its temples, spread to the sides, unquote. It had no real nose, just nostrils, and it kept its slash of a mouth closed with no teeth visible. Its hair was short and neat. Tolentino reports that the monster appeared to have a burn mark, but it's not clear where on the body that was, or whether she saw it through hair on its body or if it only had hair on its head. It had feather-like structures on its back, no visible genitals, and it moved like a robot. Even accounting for possible awkward translations from the original Spanish, the interview is really sloppy. For instance, here's Tolentino's description of the feathers. Quote, I noticed something odd on its lower back. It looked like it had feathers, something that didn't match the rest of its bodily characteristics. That's when I told myself, what the heck is that? Because it didn't match the rest of the body. Interviewer, how were those feathers? Tolentino, they were like feathers but flat on its back. At no point did they rise. Do you know what I'm saying? Interviewer, yes, I do. Were they joined by some sort of membrane? Tolentino, yes, and it looked reddish, like a mixture of copper with brown and other colors. Unquote. The interviewer asks about a membrane between the feathers, and Tolentino immediately agrees that there was one. Not only was this a leading question, I can't understand how she'd know the feathers were connected by a membrane if they remained flat against the body. I also don't understand why the interviewer would even assume that there was a membrane between feathers. That doesn't make any sense. After the description, Tolentino's report gets weirder and weirder. The thing she's described is definitely a monster, something that any reasonable person would run from. But Tolentino and her mother go outside, and her mom even runs across the street after it. A boy who worked for Tolentino's husband at his shop across the street went into the woods after the monster, where Tolentino reports he said the feather structures stood up, turned colors, and turned out to be spines, and the monster proved to have huge fangs. If a 4-foot-tall monster with spines on its back, fangs, and weird eyes came anywhere near me, I would not try to grab it. The boy and Tolentino's mother, though, both kept trying to catch the monster. Tolentino says another boy threw bottles at it. Tolentino's mother shouted, "Catch it!" to another neighbor, but the monster ran away, although it also rose into the air and wasn't actually touching the ground as it ran. Earlier, she had described it as hopping like a kangaroo. But that's just the first part of the interview. There's a second part that isn't usually discussed in cryptozoological accounts, but it's the most important part as far as I'm concerned. It's where Tolentino mentions the movie Species. Species was released in Puerto Rico on July 7, 1995. It's set in Puerto Rico at a real-life research facility. I haven't seen the movie, but I know it's about an alien-human hybrid created in a lab, which busts out and wreaks havoc. It's not clear from the interview when Tolentino saw the movie. She mentions renting the video, but it wasn't released on video until March of 1997, a full year after the interview took place, so she probably saw it in the theater. It was a mammoth hit in Puerto Rico. Tolentino gives the impression that she thinks Species wasn't entirely a work of fiction. Here's the relevant section of the interview. Quote, interviewer, so you believe in the possibility that the chupacabra is an extraterrestrial animal? Tolentino, exactly. Just like we have dogs and animals here on Earth, maybe they might have their own and have left them here to reach out to humans. I've thought about this too, you know. Interviewer, could it be a mutation? Tolentino, it could also be an experiment or who knows what. Look, we rented a movie called Species. It would be a good idea if you saw it. The movie begins here in Puerto Rico at the Arecibo Observatory. There's an experiment going on in the film. There's a girl in a glass box as a result of the experiment. They put her inside to kill her because there was something evil within her. So when they're trying to kill her with poisonous gases, she breaks the box with supernatural strength. What came out from inside the girl? It made my hair stand on end. It was a creature that looked like the chupacabras with the spines on its back and all. It even sticks something out of its mouth. Why did they make that movie? Why did they make it? And why in Puerto Rico? It was really impressive, you know. Interviewer, what was the resemblance to the chupacabras? Tolentino, yes, I watched the movie and wondered, my God, how can they make a movie like that when these things are happening in Puerto Rico? Interviewer, in other words, does it make you think that there might have been an experiment in which a being escaped and is now at large? Tolentino, yes, but they managed to kill her in the movie, but before killing her, she kept on reproducing, unquote. The monster in the movie looks a lot like the one Tolentino describes. I don't know what Tolentino saw, if anything, but if it had been as remarkable as the thing she says she saw, there would have been a much bigger outcry. But no one seems to have interviewed Tolentino's mother, the neighbors who reportedly saw the thing too, the boy who chased it into the woods, no one. For his excellent book, Tracking the Chupacabra, which I've drawn on quite a lot for this episode, and look in the show notes for the link to the book, Benjamin Radford re-interviewed Tolentino in 2010. At that point, she made some changes to some of the details from her 1996 interview. She says the monster was only about 3 feet tall, that the boy who chased it into the woods was either lying or exaggerating, and so forth. Radford investigated her claims as much as possible after 15 years had passed. At one point in the original interview, she mentions that the monster left slime behind when it killed animals, and that the slime had been tested, but the scientist didn't know what it was. Radford contacted the scientist Tolentino named, who said she had never been given any slime to test at all. In her 1996 interview, Tolentino mentions she'd been on 6 TV shows discussing the sighting in the 7 months after it occurred. She was paid for some of the interviews. She certainly got a lot of attention. Her story changes even within the 1996 interview, with details ever more fantastical and accounts of other people who saw the monster told as though she had been there herself. It's pretty obvious that Tolentino's account is just not trustworthy. I don't get the impression that she was trying to hoax anyone or that she's mentally ill. I think she's one of those people with an immersive imagination and a desire to fit herself into an exciting story. The Chupacabra had already been everywhere in the media before Species came out, with speculation that it was an escaped experimental animal, much like Puerto Rico's population of rhesus monkeys are genuinely escaped experimental animals. If you think of the Chupacabra as Tolentino's fandom at the time, she was basically just cosplaying a lively role as a witness. There were other reported Chupacabra sightings after Tolentino's, of course. Almost all of the reports come from the tabloids, though, and almost half of the Chupacabra articles were written by the same author, Ruben Dario Rodriguez, whose details grew ever more outlandish. Few reports appeared in the serious press. During the height of the tabloid frenzy, the Chupacabra entered pop culture in Puerto Rico. Songs mentioned the monster, it appeared in books and in a special edition Fantastic Four comic, and lots of Chupacabra t-shirts got sold. Farmers weren't as amused. Whatever the cause, they were still dealing with livestock being killed. But for the most part, the Chupacabra was a spooky, fun, maybe real story to talk about at work, but not really worry about, until you were walking home at night. At which point, every shadow became a potential monster. Gradually, reports of the Chupacabra started to percolate into a wider area. By late 1996, the story was becoming old news in Puerto Rico, but it was fresh to English-speaking audiences and in other Spanish-speaking countries like Mexico. In January 1997, the monster appeared in an X-Files episode. Something else happened in the late 90s that helped the story spread. The internet. If you saw that X-Files episode and had access to the internet, probably via dial-up on your 10-pound laptop, you could log on to your favorite Usenet group and read accounts from Puerto Rico, Mexico, Nicaragua, and even Texas about Chupacabra sightings. Then a supposed Chupacabra was killed in Nicaragua. In August of 2000, farmer Jorge Talavera waited up with a friend in hopes of killing whatever was attacking his sheep and goats. Talavera said he'd had 25 animals killed in 2 weeks, while his neighbor had lost 35 in only 10 days. The animals were supposedly drained of blood. That night, August 25th, they spotted 2 monsters, or maybe 3, Talavera wasn't sure, among a herd of goats. One was yellowish, the others dark. He said they were hairless, with a crest down their spines, pink-teethed, with bull-like heads. They reared onto their hind legs to attack the goats. Talavera opened fire and managed to wound one, but it and the others escaped. But 3 days later, a ranch hand spotted vultures circling and went to investigate. He found a decomposing hairless body near a small cave not far from the farm. The remains were sent to the nearby National Autonomous University of Nicaragua, where biologists examined it. The report? The Chupacabra was a dog. Talavera was furious. He claimed the bones had been switched, that the scientists were lying, that it was all in conspiracy. The tabloids went crazy again, of course. But as Radford points out, there's no reason to believe the body discovered near the farm was even the animal that Talavera shot in the first place. The remains showed no sign of a gunshot wound. In May 2004, in Elmendorf, Texas, rancher Devin McAnally shot a hairless animal that he suspected had been killing his chickens. It was a female with wrinkled gray-blue skin, rounded ears, and a long tail and long snout. McAnally buried the animal, but sent one of the teeth to New York University to find out what it was. The DNA analysis determined it was a domestic dog. Sometime around late July 2009, in Blanco, Texas, a farmer left poison out for an animal that was bothering his chickens, although none had been killed. The next morning, he discovered a dead dog-like animal, almost hairless, with long legs and bluish-brown skin. He gave the body to his cousin, Lynn Butler, who in turn gave it to a taxidermist friend, Jerry Ayer, who mounted it. Ayer soon grew tired of the media frenzy. He was inundated with phone calls, emails, and people showing up at his shop to interview him. Ayer didn't think the animal was a dog or coyote with mange, although it was certainly some kind of canid. He also didn't think it was a chupacabra. He finally sold the mounted animal to a small museum in New York, and DNA testing by the Davis Labs in California revealed it was a coyote cross. The most famous of these mystery hairless canids is the one from Cuero, Texas. This is the one you may have seen in the 2008 Monster Quest episode. I remember watching it myself. Rancher Phyllis Canyon had caught glimpses of hairless bluish animals on her property in 2007 and thought they might be the culprits killing her chickens. She'd reportedly had about 24 killed in a few years, really not that many, but she was also curious as to what the animals were. She set up trail cams with no luck. Then, on July 14, 2007, a neighbor found a strange dead animal in the road and called Canyon to look at it. While they were examining it, another neighbor called to say a second animal had been found dead in the road in front of Canyon's house. Both were nearly hairless, dog-like animals. A local TV station sent samples of the bodies to Texas State University at San Marcos. There, Dr. Michael Forstner, a biologist who does a lot of DNA testing on unknown animals, determined that Canyon's chupacabras were coyotes with mange. Canyon disagreed. By that time, she was making a lot of money selling chupacabra t-shirts and caps online. She had more DNA tests run at a genetics lab at the University of California at Davis. This time the results said coyote with at least some Mexican wolf genetic material on the father's side. Other DNA tests, apparently 5 have been done at this point, say the same thing. These are just some of the sightings of hairless dog-like animals that get called chupacabras. Most accounts come from South Texas and surrounding areas. They're nothing like the Puerto Rican accounts, which mostly followed Tolentino's species movie monster description after it became famous. There are so many reports of the hairless animals that some cryptozoologists have started calling them Texas blue dogs, since the skin is usually bluish or partly bluish. They're sometimes said to be marsupials with 2 pouches, but none of the dead animals recovered have pouches. The pouch theory seems to be due entirely to muscular or fatty bulges seen in some photographs and on dead specimens. So what are the blue dogs? Canyon, who has dubbed herself a chupacabra expert, thinks they're all hybrids of coyotes and Mexican wolves. But she also believes they suck blood, something coy wolves don't do. Coyotes, dogs, and wolves interbreed readily, so it's not surprising that a coyote would be genetically part wolf. The Mexican wolf is functionally extinct, with a very small number and a captive breeding program started with the last 5 wild individuals caught in 1980. But genetic markers don't disappear after 1 or 2 generations. A coyote can carry Mexican wolf genes from across hundreds or thousands of years before. Sarcoptic mange is probably the cause of the so-called Texas blue dogs. It's a highly contagious disease that affects all canids, caused by mites that burrow into the animal's skin. An animal with sarcoptic mange will scratch itself raw, lose almost all of its hair, typically some remains on the back of the neck and along the spine. But mange itself doesn't kill the animals directly. Most animals with advanced mange die of hypothermia, but in South Texas and other areas where the temperature rarely drops very low, an animal may get along reasonably well despite being almost completely hairless. Another possibility, much less likely, although it does seem to have resulted in at least 1 known sighting, is a breed of hairless dog called the Zolo. It's been bred in Mexico for at least 3,000 years. 2007 photographs of a hairless animal hanging around an apartment complex in Albuquerque, New Mexico, were identified by Rick Janser, manager of the Albuquerque Zoo, as a Zolo dog. It was never caught, just disappeared one day, probably dead of starvation, considering how thin it is in the photos. But if all of these chupacabras are just dogs, coyotes, or canid hybrids, what about the dead livestock? What's killing them? What's draining all those sheep and chickens of blood? Well, here's the thing. Not a single animal supposedly killed by a chupacabra has been necropsied and found to be drained of blood. After an animal dies, its blood stops flowing and sinks to the lowest area of the animal's body. To someone not trained as a veterinarian, even someone used to handling animals live or dead, it may appear that the animal is bloodless. This is especially true when newspaper reports have repeatedly claimed that the chupacabra sucks its victim's blood. Got a bunch of dead chickens in your yard, but not a lot of gore splashed around? It must be a chupacabra. But Dr. David Morales, a veterinarian with the Department of Agriculture in Puerto Rico, has necropsied some 300 so-called bloodless chupacabra kills. They all turned out to contain normal amounts of blood and showed signs of normal predation by dogs, rhesus monkeys, and even a few birds. Added to that, dogs in particular can get overexcited when surrounded by livestock and will kill as many animals as they can. This is why it's so dangerous to let dogs roam free in areas where livestock is kept. Even a well-behaved dog can fall in with a rowdy group and suddenly start biting chickens in a frenzy. Canids of all types kill prey by biting the neck, leaving puncture wounds that bleed very little externally. Most bleeding is done internally. The animal may die of suffocation from swelling of the trachea at the bite site, or it may die of shock. The dog or coyote will frequently bite several animals in quick succession, then pick one to eat on sight or drag it away to eat it elsewhere. I have firsthand knowledge, literally firsthand, of dog bites not bleeding very much. When I was in high school, I tried to stop a dog fight. Don't ever do that, okay? None of the bites I received bled much at all, even the one that required 2 stitches. If you ever run into me, ask to see the scars, although I'm liable to bore you with a blow-by-blow description of how I got them. Anyway, I'm convinced that the chupacabra isn't a real animal. It's a folktale, and the so-called Texas blue dogs are just unfortunate canids with severe mange. For those listeners who are disappointed or even angry at me for not believing the chupacabra is a real mystery animal, or at least for not leaving a note of hope at the end that maybe I'm wrong, well, I'm not an expert and you don't have to believe me. But I've drawn my conclusions after reading a lot of well-done research. I'm all for mysteries and I'd love to see a genuine mystery animal one day. I know they're out there. But I also believe in being realistic when it comes to evidence. Don't believe everything you read in the tabloids or online. And don't order chupacabra at your favorite Mexican restaurant. It probably has really tough meat, and your server is gonna look at you funny. You can find Strange Animals Podcast online at strangeanimalspodcast.com. We're on Twitter at Strange Beasties and have a Facebook page at facebook.com/strangeanimalspodcast. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for future episodes, email us at strangeanimalspodcast@gmail.com. If you like the podcast and want to help us out, give us a rating and review on iTunes or whatever platform you listen on. We also have a Patreon if you'd like to support us that way. Rewards include exclusive twice-monthly episodes and stickers. Thanks for listening. The movie begins here in Puerto Rico at
Hi, I'm Desmond.
And I'm Shalom.
And we're the Non-Historians.
Just two guys with big mouths and little historical knowledge who
take on pop history and everyday history things.
It's so close to learning that you just might.
Like the fact that Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence. Well, he composed it. However, it was physically written by Thomas Matlick, clerk to the secretary of the Second Continental Congress.
Boom. Did your mind just explode?
Available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Podbean, and other podcast catchers.
You can find us online at Not Historians on Twitter and on Facebook.